The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to
discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at
imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group,
a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement.
Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. After the attacks on Paris, American and European intelligence officials charged that ISIS is using encrypted products like WhatsApp, iMessage, and even video games for communication and recruiting. Encryption is a kind of data scrambling that keeps credit card transactions and passwords safe. Even if intercepted, it cannot be read. The Obama administration and some lawmakers are insisting that tech companies be forced to build a backdoor to encryption technologies that would allow intelligence unfettered access to interpersonal communications. Opponents argue that making our data more vulnerable would not make us safer. Here to translate for us is our chief explainer of all things technological, Rob Fleischman. He's principal architect at Akamai. Hey, Rob.
Virginia, wonderful to be here as always.
Since the Paris attacks, we keep hearing about the attackers communicating through encrypted messages and that cryptography gave them cover to plan and carry out the attacks. So what does that mean first?
Well, cryptography is a fancy, scary term, and it's really just a part of security. So we all have security in our lives, from the locks on the front door to passwords to handing out things like driver's licenses and things like that, credit cards and signatures and all kinds of – security is all part of our lives. And what cryptography focuses on is only two parts of security. It's mostly targeted at transmissions or messages. And what it does is it secures and authenticates those things. So in English, what that means is it secures them, meaning it makes sure that the person who's sending and receiving messages is the only person – those are the only parties that can see or read the data. So what that means, if I'm transmitting data to you, Virginia, whether it's over a phone call or over an email or whatever, that you're the only one who can – unencrypt it, maybe turn it from gobbledygook into something you can read. Nobody in the middle, no third party can do that. And then the second part of it is what I said before, authenticate, which means that what I sent you and what you send back to me are correct. Meaning if I sent you a bunch of information, nobody in the middle can take it out, can remove it or alter it on the way. So cryptography secures communication channels between parties. And that's really all it's really focused on, making sure that data, whether it's stored or sent, is only read by the people who are supposed to read it, basically the people with the keys, mm-hmm. the passwords, and that the data isn't altered by someone.
Okay, so as a regular old internet user, I probably come across encryption, say, if I'm buying something online. I mean, my credit card information is encrypted. Is that correct?
Exactly. So when you go to a secure website, for example, like your bank mm-hmm. or maybe your brokerage house, and you see HTTPS or you see that lock symbol, a part of the security they give you, and there's more to it than just the cryptography, but yes, they use cryptography between your web browser and the computer on the other side hosted by your brokerage house or bank to make sure that that channel between you two is encrypted. So you see that all the time, but there's actually more security and more cryptography that people don't think about, and actually Congress and people are kind of upset about. For example, you know, let's take the iPhone. When you fire your iPhone up and you go under Touch ID and passwords, you'll discover that there's data encryption. A lot of the data on your iPhone that's stored on your phone is actually encrypted. And you know, when you press the Touch ID with your thumb or you type your 4-digit password, well, that provides a key to decrypt that information. So if I just take your iPhone, take it and take it apart and access the hard drive, there's not a whole lot in there. It's all encrypted. Without those pass keys, without your Touch ID or your code, I can't really do much with it. And that's upsetting to some people in government who want to monitor and deal with bad guys.
Right. Okay. So let's stay with that simple bad guy, good guy. You know, you said you to me sending encrypted data. No one else can get in there. None of the bad guys. But in this case, of course, it is being posed as the assertion that terrorists can hide behind and communicate behind unbreakable encryption. Is that true?
Well, unbreakable, you know, that's a tough word. I would say that bad guys, terrorists, can use extremely strong cryptography to secure their communications, right? And unbreakable, well, you know, I don't know what's breakable, unbreakable, you know, as time goes on. You know, maybe 10 years from now, that stuff will be breakable really quickly. But how good is the data 10 years from now?
Right? Mm-hmm. Sort of like the Nazi codes that were cracked during the Second World War.
You know, you're exactly right, Virginia. Nothing has changed. It's exactly the same. Now, the computers are faster and the cryptography is better, but it's exactly the same. So the issue is, do we have good cryptography? Do we have bad cryptography, right? So if you have good cryptography, it's strong and we can all use it to protect ourselves, right? Protect the good guys. But the bad news about that is if good cryptography gets out, as it has, people will use it for bad things.
Well, we know that James Comey, the FBI director, he told Congress that ISIS or Daesh, however we want to refer to them, is using encrypted data to recruit Americans. And a number of congressional representatives are, you know, shaking their fists and saying, let's get rid of cryptography. First, now what does that mean, get rid of cryptography? Can you do that?
I don't know. That sounds like let's get rid of math, you know. So let's focus on some things that aren't technology-based. Now, you know, if you came to me and said, hey, Rob, you know, I want some cryptography that has some backdoor or that we can break easily or that certain people can break. Yes. Can we technically come up with things like that? Sure. Will that really work to solve this problem? I don't think so. And let's think about why, right? So who do you give this backdoor access to? So the answer is, oh, well, just the good guys, right? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, who are the good guys, you know, and how are the good guys kept good? You know, when Rob Fleischman, you know, comes up with some great algorithm with a back door and a bunch of guys show up in my house with guns and demand, you know, the secrets, you know, I'm probably going to give it to them, you know, and I don't know who those bad guys are, right? So, you know, securing everyone who's involved in this becomes impossible. And then the other problem becomes who's good, right? I mean, France right now has been a victim of these terrorist attacks and they're really our friend. And Russia has come and gone, just like France has come and gone, in terms of being an ally or being an adversary, right? Both of those countries have spied on us. We've mm-hmm. spied on them. So are they good? Are they bad? If you let them have these back doors, what are they going to use it for? So that's really a tough problem. And then finally, the United States is not the only developer of technology. So when Virginia goes to the store and has a choice of buying a phone that's secure or a phone that's maybe secure, which one are you going to buy, right? It's going to be really tough to sell this bad cryptography or devices with this bad cryptography in it to anyone.
I'm following you. Like if we were to say we're outlawing cryptography, our phones would not be secure. Our communications wouldn't be secure. But what is to say that ISIS is going to pay attention to our banning bad cryptography?
Exactly. It's the worst direction. Right now, all the good guys have bad cryptography and all the bad guys have great cryptography. Right. It actually hurts us. Right. The world is not U.S. centric anymore, especially with technology. Right. I mean, we all know that a lot of our devices aren't even made here. Right. They're made on contract with other companies that aren't U.S. companies. So the availability of great math and great cryptography is universal. You know, so ISIS, with the right amount of money, we'll be able to buy whatever devices they want, regardless of what U.S. laws are. So that's, you know, that's tough. And honestly, this July in the New York Times, there was an article published by some very prominent security experts. And they basically said the same thing. Here are these security experts saying, you know, even if we did this, this will really work against us. So, you know, you really can't hold us back here. Trying to hold back technology will result in worse problems.
Mm. All right, Rob, are we just suffering from cryptophobia at the moment?
You may be right, Virginia.
Rob Fleischman, he's principal architect at Akamai and Word of Mouth's chief explainer of all things technological. Take a moment and picture this quaint family scene. A smiling toddler sits along a wide-eyed 8-year-old. Beside them, a dutiful teenage son flanked by two loving parents. And they're all gathered around a laptop. While that image may make some people recoil, tech researcher Alexandra Samuel argues that it should not. She conducted a 2-year study on how families maneuver the digital world and discovered that restricting kids' screen time is not only unrealistic, but even counterproductive. She wrote about her findings in the Atlantic article, Parents Reject Technology Shame. And Alexandra Samuel, welcome to the Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me, Virginia.
So in the article, you make a really interesting comparison between those who completely ban screen time in the home to abstinence-only education. What are the parallels?
Well, you know, we've seen in now many decades of research over on the subject of sex ed that teaching kids only about abstinence actually leads, if anything, to higher rates of pregnancy. Because, you know, at the end of the day, sexuality is part of human existence, and kids need to be prepared for it. Well, you know, in this day and age, the internet is also part of human existence. And so when parents tightly limit screen time and keep their kids off of the internet as long as possible, really they're setting them up for a very analogous situation, which is that, you know, just as puberty is now, you know, often for kids the time that they start exploring their sexuality, it's also for kids who've been kept off the internet the first time they start exploring the online world. And, you know, if the first time you really start using the internet is when you're 13 or 14, you're probably not at a stage in life where you're going to listen to your parents a whole lot. And so if they haven't kind of bent your ear up until then and taught you how to use the internet responsibly, you're very likely to go online and make some poor decisions. And that's certainly what the data suggests.
So sort of like the kid who is not allowed to have sugar their whole life and then, you know, goes to a friend's house and gobbles it down.
Well, and it's hard to know. I mean, the data is a little ambiguous at this point, and I'm continuing to pore over it on the relative usage levels of kids whose internet access has been limited versus kids who've had more access at a younger age. But certainly, once they do get access, it seems like kids who've been kept offline are more likely to get into problematic patterns of behavior. So, for example, the thing I talked about in the Atlantic piece is I looked at the data on school-age kids who have engaged in a range of kind of problematic behaviors more than once or twice. I mean, the reality is, sadly, many, many kids stumble across online porn once or twice. But once your kids are kind of consistently looking at online porn, posting hostile comments, impersonating other people more than, you know, once or twice as an experimentation, that's when we see we've got a pattern of problematic behavior. And that kind of pattern is more likely to occur among children whose parents have strictly limited their access to the internet.
So when it comes to screen time allowance, you give us a kind of spectrum of how and where parents fall. Give us a little bit more detail on what that spectrum includes.
Yeah, well, I mean, this spectrum is really what drove the research, which began a few years ago with an observation that, you know, for all that we hear about free-range parents versus helicopter parents and attachment parents and, you know, French parenting styles versus tiger moms, I mean, boy, the media loves these stories of parenting wars. But certainly among the parents that I know, the most important division, certainly on a day-to-day basis, is the division in how parents approach screen time. And I see many, many parents who wholeheartedly embrace technology and give their kids access to, you know, Call of Duty and Halo. And at the opposite end of the extreme, I see parents who are very tightly limiting their kids' access to screens, possibly keeping them off devices altogether. In fact, the data bears out that division. We have about a third of parents who are what I call limiters. These are parents who focus on minimizing their kids' screen time and feel like the ideal is for their kids to spend as little time around technology as humanly possible. At the other end of the spectrum, we have parents I call enablers. They're another roughly third of parents, and their approach is, you know, I trust my kids' decision. I let my kids, you know, make their own decisions around technology. I defer to how other families and kids use technology. And I call those folks enablers. But it turns out that there is a middle group, again, a third of parents whose approach is to actively guide and manage their kids' use of technology. And these are folks I call mentors because they really see that in the internet age, part of the work of parenting is to teach your kids how to work and live online in a responsible way.
So you're not saying just let kids go free into the digital world, but more like that sort of image we started with, the family is there guiding kids. How much work does it take into being a digital mentor?
That's a terrific question. And, you know, again, one of the concerns I had initially was that mentorship might seem to be out of reach to many parents. But in fact, there are a great many people who mentor their kids online who are not in any way particularly tech savvy. What they are is open and curious about the internet and willing to talk to their kids directly about what it means to use the internet responsibly. They take an active role in researching what kinds of applications and tools their kids will find useful or educational or even appropriate. And essentially, instead of kind of standing on the sidelines and taking this attitude, which I think is not uncommon, which is that, oh, you know, kids understand technology better than us old people, they see that, no, you know, the internet is too big, too important, and too challenging for kids to navigate on their own. And so it's our responsibility as adults, as people with life experience, much more than tech experience, it's that human knowledge we have about what it means to engage respectfully, what it means to be compassionate. Those are the skills that we need to teach our kids to harness online, and it's our job as parents to help them understand what that means.
We all know people who limit the screen time for their kids. There are plenty of people who ban it altogether. We're speaking with Alexandra Samuel, a technology writer and researcher, about whether that's a good idea. So after taking that effort as a digital mentor, what are the results? What does your data say about how kids guided by parents use the internet?
Well, certainly they're much less likely to run into trouble, and you know, relatively few children of mentors end up consistently looking at porn, engaging in hostile conversations online, and so on. So there's just that risk avoidance piece. But I think the more exciting piece is the kind of skills and abilities that they acquire. So it's certainly the children of mentors are much more likely to know how to run a blog. They're much more likely to know how to set up a website. They're more likely to have learned some coding skills. And, you know, those kind of technical skills, when you get to the sort of high school stage, those are parts of the new literacy. If you want to be an empowered citizen of the internet, you need to be able to use the tools of that world. And thanks to the opportunities that mentor parents provide to their kids, those kids are much more likely to have those skills.
There are still, however, kids who have way too much screen time, spend too much time on the internet. So what do you think is ultimately worse, no restrictions at all or severe restrictions?
Certainly, a number of people have raised issues about the neurological impact of screens on very young children. And, you know, it's hard for me to see that a three-year-old is going to be, you know, harmed by keeping them off of iPhones and iPads and computers. It, you know, for me, the kind of concern is those in-between years, the elementary years where I think it actually is as problematic to keep kids off of screens as it is to give them too much screen time. And I think that's a challenging idea for a lot of parents. But what I worry about are these kids who reach the high school years without having had any parental guidance in what is a huge part of their lives. I mean, you know, we're horrified when we hear about these, you know, occasional horror stories of parents who keep their kids locked inside an apartment and, you know, the kids haven't made it into the outside world. Well, in some way, keeping your kid off the internet is analogous because they are going to live a huge portion of their lives in the online world. And who do you want preparing them for that? The teenagers they're hanging out with when they're 15 or you as their parent guiding them and introducing them to that space when they're in their school years?
I'm thinking about how we've heard this argument before. You know, first it was radio is going to rot your brain if you listen to those, you know, the Green Hornet show. Television will rot your brain. Video games will rot your brain. And we discover that it is not so simple or clear. But why do you think technology evokes that kind of fear in their parents that they would actually lock them in the metaphorical closet?
Well, you know, I think part of it is because we, as the parents of this generation, are kind of the last generation of parents who remember what it was like to grow up without screens ourselves. And so, you know, even though I myself am a total computer geek and love my internet, there is still a sense in which it's foreign to me, in which I still romanticize the kinds of childhood experiences I had, actually, among others, is Lake Sunapee as a kid, right? That kind of wild childhood so many of us have and which so many of us see our kids missing out on to some degree. And I think what technology does, when it arrives as quickly as this move to the online world has arrived, it does change our social dynamics. It does change the way we learn. It does change the way we communicate. And it's very hard for us to acknowledge the possibility that different isn't necessarily worse. Like, maybe our kids will have shorter attention spans. Maybe they will be kids who digest and absorb information broadly instead of deeply. Is that worse? I don't know. I mean, I think we have to remain open to the possibility that our kids will learn and interact and experience the world in ways that are very different from the way we ourselves grew up. But we need to consider that their way might be just as good as our way. It will have different benefits and different drawbacks.
Well, Alexandra, I'm so glad that Lake Sunapee contributed to your well-rounded education. And thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Virginia.
Alexandra Samuel, she's a technology writer and researcher and author of the book Work Smarter with Social Media. You can find a link to read her article for The Atlantic, which is called Parents Reject Technology Shame. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When you gaze up into the sky, maybe you find yourself wondering at its beauty and vastness. Probably one of the last things on your mind is the law. But space is exactly where the next legal frontier is being played out. And this story comes to us from Nancy Mullane in the podcast Life of the Law.
So we've landed on the moon and maybe discovered there's life on Mars. And not only are we curious, some people are hoping to make money from outer space. Because for all of us, space is the next frontier. And the U.S. Congress just might make all of it possible. They just passed a bipartisan bill known as the Space Act that sets guidelines for how to do it. Next step is for President Obama to sign it into law or veto it. And all signs point to him signing it in short order. And if he does sign it, what sort of 21st century gold rush are we all looking at? Less than 60 years ago, the idea of humans going into outer space seemed like an impossible, wild, irrational fantasy. But once man set his first foot on the lunar soil, we've all been faced with a really practical question. How do all of us humans down here on Earth share space? How do we create a body of law that governs the great unknown? Life of the Law's Kirsten Jesowitz-Heidel has the story.
Imagine it's 1957. It's the middle of the Cold War, and fear is everywhere. Senator Joseph McCarthy's just spent years accusing people of being communists and spies. The Soviet missile crisis is on the horizon. The United States and the former Soviet Union are locked in an arms race. And there's a space race, too. When you look up at the sky in 1957, there's nothing up there but stars, planets, moons, and some space rocks. It's a vast, silent sea, utterly unexplored. The only thing anyone has seen orbiting the Earth is the moon. But the U.S. and the Soviet Union are desperately competing to see who will be first to launch a man-made satellite into orbit. For most people at the time, all of this seemed really abstract, if not fantastical. Aviation was just 50 years old. Going into space was something that only happened in science fiction. Until it wasn't.
CBS Television presents a special report on Sputnik 1, the Soviet space satellite.
On October 4th, 1957, the former Soviet Union launched a polished metal sphere into low Earth orbit. It was just 23 inches in diameter and had four external radio antennae. But just like that, the first leg of the space race was over. The Soviets had beat the Americans. And then the so-called Sputnik crisis began.
And when Sputnik was launched, it caused fear and panic, not only in the United States, but around the world. A lot of people were really fearful of what is that metal object in the sky and what is it going to do?
That's Steve Mermina, a law professor at Georgetown University.
Some of these current vibrations in Washington.
Well, there's very profound concern here, Doug, about world opinion. The dominant conflict of our time, the Cold War, is at present, as everyone knows, in a state of balance between Russia and the West.
Is it going to drop weapons? Is it going to deliver weapons? Is it going to threaten us as a race or a nation or as a species?
In recent months, been threatening nations who grant bases to America. Those threats have not been taken very seriously, but now the world knows that it took a far more powerful projectile than America possesses to push that satellite into its orbit in space. In view of that, Russia's threat may be more effective now.
And as a reaction to Sputnik, countries around the world started to get together and say, we need to study outer space and make some rules as to what can and cannot occur in outer space.
The UN convened an ad hoc committee of nations. It was known as the Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, and its goal was to ensure that space would only be used for peaceful purposes. In 1967, the committee signed its first treaty, the Treaty on Principles Governing the Activities of States in the Exploration and Use of Outer Space, including the Moon and Other Celestial Bodies, better known as
the Outer Space Treaty, and more than 100 countries around the world are party to it. So some people refer to it as the Magna Carta of space.
By 1979, there were four more treaties: the Rescue Agreement, the Liability Convention, the Registration Convention, and the Moon Treaty. And no other treaties have been written since. In just over two decades, a whole new body of law was created, one that has big implications today. Take a bill just passed by Congress called the United States Commercial Space Launch Competitiveness Act of 2015, or the Space Act. This is Joanne Gabrinowitz, a veteran space lawyer.
It's a bill that addresses asteroid mining, space tourism, or what we call human commercial space flight, and remote sensing.
It's likely that President Obama will sign this bill into law. And when he does, it would regulate private companies doing anything from mining asteroids to commercial spaceflight.
As activities continue to develop, then you begin to fashion what has to be done for that specific activity if it's going to be different than what has come before.
But what came before? First, some disclosure. I'm a stone cold nerd, and I'm really into space. Movies about space? I've seen most of them. Shelves full of sci-fi novels. Yep. Star Trek? I frackin' love it. Michael Monero is an attorney and scholar of international space law. Nerding out was what led him to this field. He was already a really big sci-fi fan, and then after law school, he went to China on a fellowship. He saw in the news that the Chinese government was starting to get worried about U.S. involvement in space and the ramifications it would have on China. And he decided
to boldly go where no lawyer has gone before. The funny thing about Star Trek is there's no lawyers on the ship. You ever notice that? But they're so enlightened in the future, there doesn't seem to be a real need for lawyers in Star Trek.
So maybe there wasn't a lawyer on the USS Enterprise. But here on Earth, there's a lot of people interested in the laws that govern outer space. There's even an institute devoted to it. The International Institute of Space Law. And every year they have a moot court competition for law students. This year, it was held at Georgetown University in D.C.
URA is not liable for the damage done to Drop Gun by the airburst of SID-1 for three distinct reasons. One, Spider cannot prove...
The audio's a bit fuzzy. It was taken from a video because the competition was close to reporters.
And third, because the liability convention does not apply, we can look to the general principles of international law.
It involved a hypothetical case between two made-up nations, the Sovereign People's Independent Democratic Republic, or SPIDER, and the United Republic of Adventura, or URA. According to the case, both nations wanted to mine from an asteroid called SID-1. After URA accidentally messed with its orbit, SID-1 crashed into Drop Gum, a fishing village in Spider. Point is, there's a lot of geeking out to do when it comes to space law. And all this geekery is based on other, more terrestrial laws. Here's Michael Monero.
States undertake an activity. After a certain amount of time, there becomes a custom to that activity, a general consensus that there's a right way to do things. Eventually, that custom is elevated to the point where it has the legitimacy of a norm. And then, at some point, the states decide to write down their norms.
Pretty standard. And space law followed the same path. The only big difference was that the people writing space law were moving really fast and making up rules for places no one had ever been before. Chris Johnson works for the Secure World Foundation. It's an NGO set up to prevent space from being another domain where war is waged. He says that the founding fathers of space law even looked to the Romans.
They had to come up with these rules and figure out, well, where does a state's sovereignty begin from? And it actually goes back all the way back to Roman law, where the state said that they had sovereignty from the heavens all the way down to hell. So when the space age began, they thought, is this just a higher realm than aviation? And this is where it gets tricky.
Tricky because suddenly the heavens had no upper limit.
When you just like look out the window and look up, you think, where does state sovereignty end? And where does this freedom of outer space, this what they call international commons, where does that begin?
Good question. And that's the problem with space law. You're trying to impose rules on celestial bodies, on the infinite void.
That's what's kind of still kind of mind-boggling. And that's when I first got into space law. It seemed like science fiction that there'd be something that applies to planets and what we can do on other planets and in outer space. That's just the crazy, you know, reality of it.
Which is why space law began by looking for answers on Earth. Joanne Gabrinowitz.
We can look back to other parts of history. For example, the great age of exploration. They were going to places on the Earth that for them were just as new and adventurous as space is for us. And we learn from their experiences and then we adapt them to the current reality.
Take the Space Act, which now attempts to legislate private activities in space at the national level. It deals with liability for American space tourism companies and rights for U.S. businesses that extract resources from celestial bodies. But some people want an international agreement instead to ensure that all countries will apply space law the same way. If the Space Act is signed into law, it could open up a whole new era of space industry and a whole new era of disagreements about how humans should share outer space. Unlike many other areas of law, space law isn't set in stone yet. New rules are being written, and the old ones are constantly being tested.
And there was a case in Europe where there was somebody who claimed to own the sun because he bought it on the internet, and then there was somebody who got a sunburn, so he sued the guy who owned the sun.
That particular case was easily solved by turning to the Outer Space Treaty. Article 2 states that no one can claim any part of space. So, good news for the man who bought the sun. He couldn't be sued. But the bad news is he never actually owned the sun. Michael Monero says what's truly amazing is that space law is so young. It's still like an unexplored frontier. The final frontier.
And the rules we design today will impact our evolution across the solar system for millennia.
For Life of the Law, I'm Kirsten Josewitz-Heidel.
That story was brought to us from the Life of Law podcast, hosted by Nancy Mullane and reported by Kirsten Josewitz-Heidel and edited by Annie Murphy, with sound design by Shani Avram. Ham-fisted, painfully obvious, a little too on the nose. Whether written in the New Yorker or said at a dinner party, professional and armchair critics use these terms as shorthand to deride films and books and theater productions and TV series. Yes, when it comes to art criticism, heavy-handedness is gauche and subtlety reigns supreme. But should it? Forrest Wickman is senior editor at Slate and writer for its culture blog Browbeat, where we found his latest article, Against Subtlety. It sucks. Forrest, welcome to the program.
Hello.
What's an example of something that is now being praised for its subtlety or panned for being too obvious or heavy-handed?
Yeah, I think you see this everywhere. I guess if we're going to talk about TV, for example, then you often get a lot of praise for a show like Mad Men that tries to keep a lot of its themes a little bit more below the surface. And you know, that's a fine way of storytelling. I like Mad Men too, but I think what I object to is when that kind of storytelling and that kind of communicating is, you know, always considered superior to just putting everything on the surface in something like, I don't know, Empire or Breaking Bad.
Okay, so let's hear something that was criticized for being a bit too obvious. This is from last season of Game of Thrones. Peter Dinklage here playing Tyrion Lannister, giving an epic defense of himself when he was on trial for the murder of his nephew, King Joffrey.
Yes, Father, I'm guilty. Guilty? Is that what you want to hear?
You admit you poisoned the king?
No. Of that, I'm innocent. I'm guilty of a far more monstrous crime. I'm guilty of being a dwarf.
You are not on trial for being a dwarf.
Oh, yes, I am. I've been on trial for that my entire life.
Well, if that's not hitting it on the nose, as you said, I don't know what is. Is that what you're defending? The right to just, you know, throw it out there in a very plain way?
Yeah, I think that it's totally fine when a show or a book or a movie or whatever kind of comes out and states its themes, and it doesn't have to be too understated about it all the time so that, you know, only those with the kind of finest sensibilities will pick up on it. You know, Dinklage often gives pretty big, hammy performances, and we love him for that, even if he can kind of do a whole range.
When a work is described as subtle, it is meant to be positive. You know, that's clever. It's complex. It's cerebral. Was that always the case?
This is something I was somewhat surprised to find when sitting down to research this, is that the kind of contemporary meaning of subtle as kind of being understated or oblique and that being a positive thing is relatively new. Up until, you know, before the last century or two, subtle meant something much closer to kind of obscure or abstruse. And you can find all these quotes from people like Milton who are just kind of criticizing things that are too subtle for being basically just kind of nonsense or even kind of underhanded. So there was a skepticism of things that were subtle for being kind of devious.
But the tide turned, what, around the early 20th century in modernism, as you point out. Tell us what was going on then, when this concepts of highbrow and lowbrow became very distinct.
You know, over the course of the 19th century, we had some pretty big events, a couple of industrial revolutions around then, and that resulted in a huge, you know, the explosion of the masses, and then right after that, just increasing educational reforms. So all of a sudden, the result of all of this was that you had a much larger reading public than normal. A lot of the modernists were skeptical of this, or they were worried about what the masses, this huge reading public, how they would change art, how the market would affect their art. And a lot of them, you know, not all, but some of them wanted to resist that a little bit, and some of them openly advocated making their work more obscure.
What are some examples of great works that were dismissed at the time for being too on the nose?
You know, I was I had a suspicion that we, you know, overvalue subtlety in the short term, but then in the long term we look back at things and we kind of stop caring about whether they live up to our standards of subtlety. So if you look back at reviews of things like The Great Gatsby or Hitchcock movies like Psycho and Vertigo, you'll often find critics kind of sniffing at them for being a little too blunt or for being a little too melodramatic or a little too obvious in their symbolism. And I don't think that we really care about that anymore.
Well, when I think of it, I think of, like, you know, sort of all caps, you know, making things very, very clear, which is something that I resist. And I think in defense of subtlety, isn't digging for subtext a satisfying intellectual exercise? You know, doesn't it challenge us and make us a little more critical?
You know, I certainly enjoy digging for subtext and hidden meanings and picking up on obscure references and so on. A lot of the writing I do as kind of a culture blogger and culture critic involves doing those things. I just speaking for myself, I often love that I picked up on something, and it makes me more fond of whatever that movie or book was. And I don't really think it should. I don't think that it necessarily, you know, makes us smarter or better citizens of the world if we're trained to just pick up on these subtle things in art. It's just not really a relevant skill to the real world.
I wonder if that's the real hit there, that it makes us feel smarter if we pick up on subtlety.
I think that's part of it. The kind of the converse is also true, where if something is really obvious to you, then sometimes you might think that, oh, this thing is kind of speaking down to me. You hear that a lot from critics and audiences. You hear that some piece of art insults their intelligence. And I've had that feeling before, but I think since writing this, I've tried to be more conscious of, oh, is it really that important whether this movie has the proper estimation of my intelligence, or is it more important that, you know, it speaks in a way that anyone would pick up on that fun reference that I enjoyed picking up on.
Do you love to peel back the complex layers of cultural references in Mad Men, or find yourself drawn to the 10-yard stare of Don Draper? Or do you prefer the direct language of Walter White in Breaking Bad? Well, I'm talking about The Art of Subtlety with Slate's culture critic Forrest Wickman. Forrest, earlier you were talking about the appreciation for subtlety emerging from this desire for artists and critics to separate themselves from the masses. But is the embrace of subtlety still a matter of cultural hierarchy? I mean, I'm looking at the most watched shows of 2015. This is last season. Right at the top, The Big Bang Theory. Now, that could be named for, you know, the clanking to announce each joke. But then there are all these kind of NCIS and police procedurals and, of course, Monday and Thursday Night Football. But to the police procedurals, how do we explain the love of mystery and suspense if subtlety is not part of the draw?
I think I would make a distinction there between mystery and subtlety. I'm trying to think of an example. I guess, for example, you know, the great stories of Sherlock Holmes, there's kind of no question what the mystery is or what the answer ended up being at the end, and yet we still enjoy those stories and study them. You know, I don't want to make too nuanced a distinction, but I think I see one there.
So 50 to 100 years from now, are the most heavy-handed television shows and authors and, you know, bang-you-over-the-head kind of movies going to be the most popular?
I think more than we might expect, but I think we may overestimate how important it is that a piece of work is understated.
I'm just wondering if this even in itself is kind of a criticky circle kind of argument, subtlety versus non-subtlety.
It's definitely true that I see it most often with critics, and I definitely think there are plenty of people who just, you know, go to the movies or turn on the TV and never worry about whether what they're watching is subtle or not. And I think it might be good if we keep those people in mind a little more.
Or as one of my colleagues said today, How to Get Away with Murder is the least subtle show on TV, and it's great.
Absolutely.
Well, Forrest Wickman, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Forrest Wickman, he's senior editor at Slate, where he writes and edits Slate's culture blog, Browbeat. You'll find a link to read his article, Against Subtlety, it's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. So grateful for your listening time today, and there is much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There is a link to subscribe, again, wordofmouthradio.org, or you can search for Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, tell a friend, or even tell someone you don't know by rating it on iTunes. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow, too, here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan, and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.